There's no way around it, Mike Leonard. Big news, obviously, in the world of federal indictments against former President Donald Trump. If you weren't going to be on the schedule, you would have been in this chair no matter what anyways, Mike. So thanks. I'm glad you were in lineup already to come on with us today.
Great to be here. Yeah, I thought you might want to talk about the Trump indictment, John. I thought it might pique your interest a little bit.
Well, there's so much to get at, right? And this has really riled up both the left and the right. Some people cheering this on, some people decrying it as the Biden administration going after a political rival. I want to kind of get the facts, lay the foundation. I want to answer people's questions, calm, collected, factual questions you may have. 312-981-7200. I think the best place to start with this, Mike, is what are the charges?
Sure. Before we do that, John, I want you to call me out and scold me. Okay, can you just get that out of the way?
Yeah, after the raid at Mar-a-Lago, which was last August, you were on the show either the week after or the week after that. And a couple times in those months, I asked you, do you think that an indictment will stem from this? And you said no. And I guess you've been proven wrong.
I was wrong, John. I said there would be no charges. But I didn't know a lot of the material that's in the indictment. I think what's surprising to many of us, and pretty much to everybody, is the extent to which they allege that Trump himself was involved. Like his handprints are in every single, part of the process.
Right, because you had said it would be hard to prove that Trump knew everything, that he orchestrated it. He could, potentially say, I was naive to the fact that these boxes were there. It appears that, at least in the indictment page, and before we start anything, President Trump is innocent until proven guilty.
That's true, of course.
Presumed innocence. I just want to get that out there. We're talking about alleged things that are in the indictment right now. And you, of all people, would appreciate that as a federal defense attorney.
Of course, yes.
I want to just say that. Okay. Walk us through what we got here.
Yeah, so it's a wide-ranging, 49-page, 37-count indictment. The first 31 counts are what's called willful retention of national defense information. In other words, keeping documents that are of a sensitive nature or confidential or highly secret nature that you're not supposed to have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, that's been talked about for an awful long time publicly.
Ad nauseum about whether he could have them, whether
correct.
He could not.
And I think, John, the biggest difference in those counts is that we've been talking publicly for so long about, hey, what's the big deal? He's got these documents. Why do we all care about it? Are they really of particular significance that
right.
That would be something that we could all agree upon would be troublesome for someone to have? And I think, at least according to the allegations, the answer is yes, and decidedly so.
So it's what's in the boxes that is troublesome to the
prosecutors. Yeah, we're not talking about, government organizational charts and memos and things like that. We're talking about, at least according to the allegations, document after document that range from things relating to nuclear capabilities and strategy to strategy about invading other countries, namely Iran, to documents that were shared with our country from other countries regarding intelligence issues, things about intelligence capabilities, things about intelligence and defense vulnerabilities.
Right. Our own government saying, what are we vulnerable about?
Correct. So, when you read the indictment and you see the nature and substance of the types of documents they're talking about, it is a little troubling. Let's face it. You wouldn't think that you'd want these in anyone's hands. You certainly wouldn't want them in anyone's hands where others could get to them. And it kind of, the thing that no one's really talked about yet, but I'm sure they will. If you remember a few years back, there was actually a Chinese spy or Chinese spy ring.
At Mar-a-Lago.
Found at Mar-a-Lago. So you know that other governments are still trying to infiltrate Trump at Mar-a-Lago and other places because they know they're aware of the sloppiness with which Trump handled these documents and his team, and they're aware of the sensitive nature of the documents.
Right. And I just want to point out, I know a lot of people might immediately say, wait, he was president, he was authorized, some people say he could think that they're declassified, and they are. There's disagreements about that. Some people he could just say it. Some people think there needs to be some more bureaucratic process. No matter where you fall on that, it appears that, allegedly, Jack Smith, the prosecutor, has Trump on tape saying, I can't declassify this now. I'm not the president anymore. Like, knowing that the document that he has in his hands is not declassified.
Yeah, that's always tough to defend against. First of all, federal prosecutors love tapes,
Mm-hmm.
In any federal trial, if they can introduce a tape, they love it. No matter what the tape's about, they're going to try to get into evidence. But here, you know, the tape is certainly directly on point because it goes to Trump's state of mind, his willfulness, his intent to evade. You know, and of course, there's always different interpretations to any tape, right? But the tape everyone's talking about, you know, there's a couple of them where one, he makes the admission in the tape that, hey, I could have declassified this document, but I didn't. And it's too late for me to do it now.
Right.
Okay. Which is kind of a directly on point admission, which has undermined kind of the PR campaign.
That he waved a magic wand and they were all declassified.
For many months. Or that he in good faith thought that they were classified. So you have him on tape making what seems to be a clear admission that he understands that there were steps that he could have taken maybe to declassify him, that he didn't do it. And it's kind of interesting and unusual that, and I don't know if he's showing off or what he's doing, but his terminology, he's saying things like, hey, this is secret. This is secret information. Right. So pretty damning admissions, you know.
Though he wouldn't be the first person in Washington ever to show off, I know something you don't know, right?
Exactly. Well, one of the things that's been talked about is, you know, sort of the motivation for this, okay? And, you know, some of the alleged admissions that he made came at a time where he was upset because there was a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who's getting a lot of public credit for allegedly reigning in Trump on the January 6th issues and also just getting a lot of praise for his actions during the administration of stopping Trump from doing things. That's what people lauded him for. And apparently Trump was very angered by that and the attention that gentleman was getting. And some of this allegedly was in response to say, hey, what this guy's saying is not true. And gee, I have the documents to show it. Looks like we may have a call.
Well,
John,
we'll see. Iridian will screen through the callers and such like that. But, okay. So 31 counts about having these documents.
Yeah. And before we move on from the tape, right? You know, tapes are portrayed in an indictment in a particular way. They're only portrayed in a way that's most favorable to the government. You know, this document is not just a charging instrument. It's also a PR piece. It is.
Mm-hmm.
Because you understand that not only is the public at large going to have a lot of questions and issues about the indictment, but you're also educating your potential jury pool as extensively as you can. And you want a document out there that people are going to read and people are going to be influenced by. So you want it to be the strongest possible document. So let's keep in mind that the tape and the portrayal of the tape and the circumstances under which it made and what its meaning and interpretation is presented in a way that's completely favorable to the government, of
100%.
Course. Yeah. So let's just keep that in mind. But of course, on its face, it looks bad.
Yes. But of course, there could be an argument in court that makes perfect sense that the Trump team comes up with to explain some of these things that picks apart the evidence. And that's what the trial is all about.
Yeah. There's always context to any audio tape or videotape. And of course, you know, what's not presented is usually the defense. Well, let's look at the other part of the tape. The government didn't play you this part.
Right.
They didn't want you to hear it, did they?
Right.
And we've had that in our own trials where, you know, we've had, you know, significant portions of a tape where the government didn't play in its case in chief. And either we put it in on cross-examination as under sort of the rule of completeness, or we waited till our case and put it in to show, like, what are they hiding from? You know, mm-hmm. they didn't want you to hear this. And sometimes that's very effective as a rebuttal to the government's case.
Okay. So those are 31 counts. Where do we go from here, Mike?
So you got those first 31, John, and we actually have the document with us today, John, so we're not just talking off
through
the top of our head.
He's looking at the document now.
A long way to get to...
Do you need me to fill some time while you scroll?
No.
You got it?
I got
right.
No, count 32 is a conspiracy to obstruct justice. And, you know, government prosecutors, particularly in the Fed, they love conspiracy counts because oftentimes they're easier to prove than the actual object of the conspiracy. You know, so you have what you're conspiring to do, but you don't have to prove the completion of that crime, right? But what a conspiracy requires in general is two or more people who reach an agreement to commit an unlawful act to violate a law. And then, you know, the jury instructions are going to say that whoever the co-conspirators are with Trump, they didn't have to know the particular law that they're violating. The government doesn't have to prove that, but they knew they were violating a law.
Okay.
And in this case, you know, it was pretty clear that there were laws applicable to the handling of these documents. I don't think it'll be hard to prove that the object of the conspiracy was to violate a law. The question is going to be, okay, who along with Trump agreed to form this conspiracy and what did they agree to do, right? Mm-hmm. In general, what the government seems to be alleging in the indictment is that some of Trump's close advisors, which are an interesting group, you know, they range from low-level personnel who mm-hmm. work at Mar-a-Lago to a person who's, I think his name is pronounced Nauta, N-A-U-T-A.
The body man.
Who's more of a higher-level person who I think has a military background. And they allege that he was intimately involved with Trump in the conspiracy, i.e. that those two, along with others, reached an agreement to evade the subpoena, to evade court orders, to evade the investigation by taking actions to make it appear that the documents didn't exist or misrepresenting what the documents were that they actually had.
We'll get to some of the other charges in a moment. We do have some questions coming in. You mentioned the jury, and you have a lot of experience in this. This would be a jury trial, right?
Absolutely. So this case, so everyone knows, the venue, meaning the location, is in the Southern District of Florida, federal court. So the jury pool will be drawn from within that district. The interesting thing is they're having the arraignment in federal court in Miami. The judge who's presiding over the case, Judge Cannon, we'll talk about her a little bit more. Yeah. Her courtroom is actually in Fort Pierce, Florida, and not in the Miami courthouse. So the remaining question is she going to preside over the case in the Miami courthouse? Is it going to be the Fort Pierce courthouse? And depending upon what the actual location is, what impact will that have on the jury pool from the district?
And it would need to be a unanimous verdict like any other, right?
Exactly, yeah. So everyone would probably know this already, but in a criminal case of any kind, you have to have unanimity, meaning, I can't even say the word, John.
Unanimity.
What it means is you have to have all 12 people say guilty or not guilty, right?
Right.
And so you often hear people say, oh, it just takes one. It takes one person to hang the jury, meaning if they deliberated for a long period of time, and after the judge told them to continue to deliberate, if they couldn't reach a verdict because they couldn't get 12 people to agree, at some point in time, the court would declare a mistrial. However, the case could be tried again.
Okay, this question deserves more than 30 seconds, but that's what we have time for before our break in news. The texter who said about the jury, is it unanimous? If all it takes is one vote of innocence in Florida, no chance that there will be a guilty verdict. Do you have more faith in juries that will be able to put up blinders? Either way in this case, fine, even if you're an anti-Trumper, you could maybe find him not guilty because the government didn't prove their case. Or if you're a pro-Trumper, that even one of those folks could find Trump guilty based on the evidence presented. Do you have faith in the jury system in America to do this?
And you only give me 30 seconds to answer, John.
I don't even know if I... Tell you what, that's a tease. I'll give you more time okay. after this break and the news on WGN. We're talking with Mike Leonard, who's a federal defense attorney, LeonardTrialLawyers.com. People very fired up here on the text line, the call lines too, 312-981-7200. Lots of questions about what's going on with the Trump indictment. Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers here to break it down. Okay, we've been talking about the indictments, the counts. Someone had a great question about the jury, about there's no chance you'd get a unanimous jury, probably in either direction. Do you have faith in the jury system in Southern Florida and D.C., wherever it may be, to do the right thing?
I really do. And, you know, there's a couple points about it. First of all, it's a great question because that's what people are talking about, too. But we got to start with the process that would be employed. So first of all, it would probably be the most vetted potential jury we've ever seen. You know, in terms of most federal cases these days, there's a very extensive jury questionnaire, which you've talked about on your mm-hmm. show. Okay, in a case like this, it would be even more extensive, you know, because both sides would want to know a lot of detail about everyone's life and political leanings and organizations they belong to and all sorts of things, right? So, number one, the jury pool, the veneer, would be very vetted. There'd be a lot of information that the attorneys would know about them. And why does that matter? Because there's a jury selection process, right? And so what both sides would be attempting to do would be to move to exclude jurors either for cause, meaning there's a basis that they've disclosed that would show they can't be, you know, fair and impartial, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why you'd want to ferret out questions about their political leanings and all that sort of stuff, right? And, you know, some of the common questions are, you know, if the government proved their allegations, would you be able to return a verdict in favor of the government? You know, vice versa. You know, if Mr. Juror or Ms. Juror, if the government didn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, are you able to return a verdict? You know, those are obvious questions, which are lead to obvious answers. If you, you know, if you're trying to be on the jury, not be on the jury, you can understand where the question's going. But there's lots of other questions they'd be asked, and which would create fodder for an attorney to try to excuse them for cause, meaning there's some showing they can't be fair and impartial. But you also got to keep in mind that defense lawyers get typically 10 peremptory challenges, mm-hmm. right? So I can knock off 10 potential jurors for no reason at all. I don't have to tell the court why. And, you know, the government has lesser peremptory challenges, and they don't have to tell the court why either. So an unfettered right to get rid of a certain amount of jurors for no reason at all, right? But still, in any case, it doesn't seem like you ever have enough challenges, especially mm-hmm. as a defense lawyer.
Right.
Because there's so many potential jurors that you view, at least in your own mind, as potentially unfavorable to you. Okay, but so a lot of the biases and prejudices will be ferreted out. People who are, you can say, dumb enough or honest enough to say things that could get them excluded, they're going to get excluded. And what happens, John, a lot of times in juror pools is the people that you most want on your jury as a defense lawyer say things and you're like, why did you say that? Mm-hmm. You know? Because it shows an overwhelming and obvious bias, and you would have loved to have the person on your jury, but they just gave the government prosecutor the absolute basis to kick them off for cause, you know.
Right.
So many people are like, oh wow, I love that person, they would have been so great for us, why did they say all those things that they did? Sometimes people can't help themselves. Also, sometimes people are really trying hard to get off the jury, you know?
And you've been surprised by juries, right?
Oh yeah. You know, so as we've talked about, we've won a great number of cases in federal court in Chicago at trial with juries, and every time we've won, literally while the jury's deliberating, which can be anywhere from hours to days, you're sitting there in your little conference room, you know, thinking about everything that happened at the trial, all the mistakes you think you made, mm-hmm. and why you're going to lose. And you're killing yourself that, oh my God, I can't believe I did this or that. That's why we're going to lose. And they come back in your favor, right? And at other times where you think you have an unbelievable defense, it seems clear that you should win and you lose. So, you know, it's a great question by the viewer. But for anyone to say that there's a lot of predictability to juries, it's absolutely not true.
Right.
It's so unpredictable.
A lot of people chiming in. President Biden had classified documents they found. Mike Pence had documents they found. I guess it's a two-part question. What's the difference, which I think I know the answer is, between that and what President Trump is allegedly to have done? And I'll ask part two after you answer it.
Yeah, well, let's keep in mind, on Pence, my understanding is from what they've said publicly, they've got his documents back. They've cleared him. He's not a target of any, you know, inquiry at this point. That's what's been reported publicly.
He voluntarily gave it back.
Yeah. With regard to Biden, let's keep in mind, my understanding is there's still a special counsel. Right now, as we sit here, there's still a special counsel investigation of Biden's handling and retention of documents. So it could or could not result in charges. We don't know. It's too early to tell. The huge difference as far as what we know right now, and you would argue maybe the dumb thing that Trump did, is that all the things that he did to allegedly cover it up and all the personal involvement that he had, at least according to the allegations, you know, most politicians, you know, as we know from lore, even in Illinois, try to keep their hands off. They try to keep an absence of a paper trail mm-hmm. for whatever they're doing. Unfortunately, at least according to the allegations for Trump, he was involved in every step of the way, meaning selecting certain boxes and certain documents to be taken, then directing people, according to the allegations, to, first of all, put them in one place in Mar-a-Lago, and then in response to the subpoena and requests to have people move them, and in some instances, according to the allegations, move them so that even the lawyers didn't know they had been moved and that certain of the documents didn't exist. So, you know, we talked about this. We thought, you know, months ago that one of his strongest defenses was going to be that he was relying on counsel.
Mm-hmm.
That turns out might be the thing that might cook him here. Because at least according to the allegations of the indictment, and we'll talk about the evidence, but one of the allegations and one of the strong allegations is that, you know, he hid things from his own attorneys. He also directed attorneys to, at least according to the allegations, remove certain documents and say, oh, they never existed, or to destroy them, or made suggestions that, hey, maybe we just don't comply, or maybe we pretend like these things don't exist. All right.
Right. And that was after a subpoena.
Yeah, that was after a subpoena. So here's the problem, and we've talked about this on your show in the past. There's something called the crime fraud exception. What does that mean? So typically, attorney-client communications are shielded from disclosure. And there's good reason for that, right? You know, you're not supposed to get your communications with your client. The other side shouldn't get those. The government shouldn't get them. There's this exception, which is called the crime fraud exception. If the government can make a showing to a court in a sealed filing that there's sufficient reason to believe that there's communications about the commission of a crime, then the attorney-client privilege is waived and the attorney is forced to turn over the documents, which, of course, if they really are discussing a crime, are going to be very damning, mm-hmm. right? And so that's what happened in this case. During this investigation, while at the grand jury stage, they sought an order from the court to compel a Trump lawyer or lawyers to testify under oath before the grand jury, and more importantly, to produce their documents and records of their communications with Trump.
Right.
Why is that a problem? Because, at least according to the allegations, one of the attorneys who was forced to testify and turn over his records, he was very meticulous. So he not only took really good notes of everything that Trump told him to do and not to do, he then, which I find unusual and we can talk about more, he would then employ a system where he would dictate his notes. So he had verbal notes of his notes about what he was told that he created contemporaneously, which leads to a lot of questions. Yeah. You know, I mean, it sounds like the lawyer was worried about what the discussions were and was worried about his own skin, you know, that maybe I'll be charged. So I want to have a very clear record of what I was told to do
right.
and what I did or did not do. And what's interesting, those attorneys have not been charged.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, this doesn't break attorney-client privilege, like you're saying, because it was brought, they had to compel this evidence, or they had to testify because it was the idea be that it could be in further
furtherance of a crime. Right. Yeah, so one of the, I think we got a listener call, but one of the things that...
I got to go to break, Mike.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So let's end there. Allowed,
we have to take breaks today,
we got to do breaks. We got to do things. We're running out of time.
We got to make ad revenue.
You keep on saying,
revenue?
Like, oh, we'll Come get on. To that later on. I'm like, I don't think we're going to, Mike. We got to fly through this stuff.
All right.
We do have a question from the 847 who I've been chatting with back and forth on the text line.
Can we take one listener call?
Yeah, after the break, Mike.
Okay.
Jeez.
Okay.
Do you even have headphones in front of you?
No.
That's why I'm waiting till the break.
Of course.
I'm thinking through this.
You're going to kick me off the show, I think.
Here's the one question I want you to think about, and you'll answer after the break. Should we even be doing this? This is a former president of the United States. Is this really a good thing? Does this create confidence in the country we have? There's two ways to take that. There's a lot of ways to take it. Well, I want your take after this.
Great question.
All right, Mike Leonard here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Well, Mike Leonard's there. I'm John Hansen. I'm over here. Mike Leonard's now moved to a place he can listen to the listener question. But first, should we be doing this as a country? Even if you look at, I'll just let you answer it. Is this damaging, so damaging to the country that it's maybe not worth it to indict a former president?
It's a real tough question. You know, When I said months ago that I didn't think this was going to result in an indictment, a lot of that was because I was of the view, like, you know, if he gives the documents back, why does it matter? Let's just get the documents
back. The government has them back. What are we doing here?
Correct. But I think, you know, if you take as true right now the allegations, that they're only allegations, it's the cover-up and the calculatedness of the cover-up, which makes it understandable why the prosecutors would want to pursue this case. I mean, you can't really have anybody at any level. If this wasn't a president, if this was an average person, we wouldn't be having this discussion. If someone was trying to cover up documents, hide them, secrete them, and especially if they're of the nature that they're alleged to be. I mean, we're talking about nuclear programs, defense capabilities, defense vulnerabilities. If this was the average person, there's no question in one second they'd be indicted. So I understand why they did indict. I also understand why it's going to be a troublesome process for the country. And in terms of bringing us together, it's certainly not going to do that. But I understand and think it was a fair decision by the special prosecutor to bring the case in light of what is alleged to have taken place, by Trump and his team.
815 says, it sounds political, John, when you ask that question. The law is the law. He compromised our safety. He broke the law. How can you ask that? The listener asked that, and but I think it's an interesting question. I mean, it's about the future of our country.
A lot of people think, hey, you know, it's a political issue, we should move on. But when you're talking about obstruction, intentional obstruction of justice and all those kinds of issues, then it gets in the realm of, and especially coupled with the nature of the documents, it becomes very understandable why you would pursue charges. And of course, as we say, no one's above the law. And oftentimes what gets people, unfortunately, is the cover-up, not the actual underlying offense.
Right. I want anyone who commits a crime, obviously there's prosecutorial, you know, leeway there on certain things, a high crime like this is alleged, of course I want people to be held accountable for that. I just, on the other side of my brain, worries about where we go as a country, right? This is a really troublesome thing. And so then it's like, okay, do we stick with the principle or do we stick with keeping the country together? But some people could say that if this is the evidence that's shown, if they don't charge him,
yeah,
the other side of the country is going to go insane. That how can you let him do this?
Exactly. Allegedly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it comes down to, look, unfortunately, it appears from the allegations that he made a lot of missteps, and it's unclear why, but if he would have given the documents back, we're not even having this discussion.
All right, let's get to John. John's on WGN. Sorry, John, thanks for holding. What is your question?
Sure. My question is, how long do you think this trial is going to take, and when do you think the case would likely be tried?
Good question. What do you think, Mike?
Good question. So a lot of speculation about whether they can really get the case to trial before the election in 2024. Typically, a federal case, you know, some of the commentators have been saying, oh, federal cases take years to get to trial. Not necessarily true, you know, and it depends upon how quickly the judge moves her docket. But you could anticipate in a typical trial, even a case of this nature, it could get to trial in anywhere from a year to 2 years, I would say is a fair estimate. But if you're the Trump team, you're going to do everything you can to file all the good faith motions you can to attack the indictment, to attack the production of documents pursuant to the crime fraud exception. You're going to raise lots of pretrial motions. So I don't think it's realistic that this case can go to trial before the election. That seems highly unrealistic to me, but it seems realistic that it would go to trial sometime in the following year in 2025. In terms of the length of the trial, I would say, and it's pretty complex, I would say it would take probably weeks. And then the interesting question is, you know, they don't allow cameras in the courtroom for these federal cases. So it'd be interesting if they made an exception for a case like this because of what a great public interest it is to everybody.
Everyone should watch what happens.
I think there would be a real value to have it made public. So there's no questions about how it's conducted, what the testimony evidence is, what it's not. I think it'd be a great thing to have it publicized.
I think that the camera should be in the Supreme Court. I think it's long overdue.
And John, you could send me as a correspondent to cover the case from under the WGN huge budget.
Yeah, for sure. We're just scratching the surface. Mike, can you pencil in next week, even if you're not on the schedule,
sure,
to call on in? Because I have some more questions for you.
Sure, I've enjoyed it.
We've got about 2 minutes left. What are you working on? What's going on in your world? You're obviously a busy federal defense attorney. Anything you want to highlight that you got going on?
All sorts of fun stuff. We start a trial that's related to sort of alleged business fraud. We got a really great client. I'm really optimistic about our opportunity to win the case at trial in federal court. That's in a couple weeks. We've just been involved in a trial in state court about 2 weeks ago where we're defending somebody on an attempted murder charge, and the defense was self-defense, and we're able to win, which was great. He was only convicted of a much lesser charge, so that was very fun. We just filed a criminal appeal in a state court case alleging that the judge essentially recited the evidence and got the evidence completely wrong in his ruling, so that's kind of a fun one. And then, you know, the rest of the summer and fall months of this year are going to be filled with federal criminal trials, so it's going to be a fun year.
When I was when you were reading through the indictment, I know you read it earlier, the President Trump's indictment, former President Trump's. Can you read that as just like a average Mike Leonard, or are you like trying to pick it apart because that's how your defense attorney brain works?
Yeah, both, of course. You're looking at the indictment, you're kind of looking like, oh, that sounds strong, or that sounds questionable, or that sounds weak, or that sounds attackable. Well, yeah, you can't really divorce yourself from any indictment that you read, especially one like this. Because most indictments in federal court are very bare bones and almost to a level that you don't even think is fair. You don't even think even gives you enough notice of what the actual charges are. But in federal court, that's really the norm, that they're very bare bones. So this is unusual. But as we said, there's a multi-purpose for this indictment. It is supposed to be a public piece, a PR piece. They want people to know from the get-go exactly what their evidence is, which is unusual. The prosecutors don't always just, you know, show their hand, so to speak, like they do in this piece.
Okay, last question then for you. You read it. You don't have to answer this if you don't feel comfortable. As someone who's read a lot of indictments, do you think it's, just generally speaking, an indictment you've considered weak, average, or strong?
I would say it reads as pretty strong. I mean, because of the way they describe the nature of the confidential documents, they did a very good job of even someone who's jaded and thinks this is a politically oriented prosecution. When you see and hear about the types of documents that are at stake, I think it's compelling. And then the second part, which I think makes it compelling, is just the evidence that they have. They got lucky, like we said before. They got attorney's notes. They got tape recordings. The evidence that looks to support their allegations of the cover-up. So if I'm the government, I'm feeling pretty good about it. But look, the defense is going to have a strong case to make against this in numerous ways. So there's going to be a very vigorous defense. And it's anyone's guess as to whether the prosecution can really prevail in light of things like the jury pool, in light of all sorts of things we're not talking about that go into jurors' minds. So at the same time, I view it as a very defensible case.
Right. I'm happy that on the text line I've been called both ultra MAGA and a communist in the same hour. Well, I must be doing something
just
right.
Just so the viewers know, you're wearing a MAGA hat and a communist hat. And a Biden hat. You got three hats going on. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're a little late. I'm sorry, Mike. What time? What number should people reach you at?
312-380-6559. John, call any time, day or night.
Don't tell me that because you know I will. I've been texting you all week long. All right, we got news. Just a couple minutes late from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom after this on WGN.